Welcome back to Being Curious with Nomi.
We have a very special guest with us on Being Curious today, author Catherine May. Catherine May is an internationally best-selling author and podcaster living in Whitstable, UK. Her most recent book, Enchantment, became an instant New York Times and Sunday Times bestseller. Her internationally best-selling hybrid memoir, Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times, was adapted as BBC Radio 4's Book of the Week and was shortlisted for the Porchlight and Barnes & Noble Book of the Year. The Electricity of Every Living Thing, her memoir of a midlife autism diagnosis, was adapted as an audio drama by Audible. Catherine's podcast, How We Live Now, ranks in the top 1% worldwide, and she has been a guest presenter for On Being's The Future of Hope series. Catherine lives with her husband, son, two cats, and a dog. She loves walking, sea swimming, and pickling slightly unappealing things. Catherine, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
It's nice to actually have someone on this side of the pond with me, with these three in the United States.
Right. Isn't it amazing now that we just hop on these calls that stretch all these distances? We've forgotten to be amazed by it, but 5 years ago, we wouldn't have been able to do this.
Absolutely. It's so true. It's so true. And how very on character to be amazed by a wonderful small thing. Yes. Which, speaking of amazement, or rather enchantment, the reason why the wonderful Catherine May is on our podcast is a bit of a wild story that starts with wild garlic. Because Maggie was over here visiting me in the UK, and I was reading Catherine's new book out loud to her while we were sitting in beautiful parks and National Trust properties over a few days. And she got this email, this newsletter from you, Catherine, which said you were going to be speaking. And Maggie went, oh my God, Catherine May is going to be speaking while we're literally reading your book. And it just felt like a sign that we should go and see you. And on our adventures, because we traveled from where I am in Windsor to Bath and then to Oxford to listen to you, we ended up at a National Trust property where we were actually encouraged to pick wild garlic, which felt magical as we're like floating around talking about enchantment and being out in the wild, listening to your book out loud, and on our way to see you. But we ended up with this bag of garlic that I was convinced everyone could smell around me.
It's pretty potent, isn't it? I don't think I could smell it. I think I could see that you're clutching a bag or something.
Clutching my garlic for dear life, dreaming of pesto. And so when we went to get our book signed, I had said to Maggie, hold my garlic. And so it all began. And we figured we were at least memorable enough to extend an invitation. And we were so grateful that you said yes, because we can't think of a better person to talk about curiosity with.
I'm very grateful, but you should have tried to bribe me with the garlic. That's all I'm saying.
Do you know what? I did say to Maggie that we should have given you the garlic.
She did. I walked away.
Grace bribes.
I said, Catherine smelt the garlic. And Madeline's like, did you like give her a handful? And I was like, no.
Shut up. My garlic. No.
I'm just taking it back to my premiere inn and worked out what to do with it after that.
Right.
Just so that you would have woken up smelling like garlic. Honestly, do you know what? The gift that keeps on giving, National Trust Properties. Sounds like an ad for them at this point, but truly it was magical. That is how you ended up on our podcast. And this podcast is all about curiosity. So I'm just going to dive right in with the easiest question in the world, which is, Catherine, what do you think is the biggest obstacle to curiosity in the world today?
Oh my goodness. Only one. There's so many, I think, really. I think it's cultural. I think we suppressed curiosity in our teenagers quite hard, actually. And then we struggle to get it back when we're adult. I think there's this huge fear of being wrong, which means that we don't do the step back from that and just express natural curiosity. And there's a fear of giving offense, so we don't ask questions that we really want to ask, which sometimes I think would help us to understand better. And I think we're so busy. We are so wildly busy all the time, and we don't make time to just notice what we're wondering about, let alone to do the wondering.
You just read the inside of my brain out loud, like a list.
Right.
And this is what caught, I think, at least my attention in the talk that you gave. Was I loved the book. We've all read the book now, but it was this comment that you made about being in process. And it was something that you touched on in your book when you talked about how sure everyone seemed of themselves on social media and how that creates a barrier to be a part of the conversation. And so I love what I'm hearing, another way of saying this, that it comes from this busyness, it comes from this shutting down, but that it is really hard to be in process.
It's vulnerable. It's incredibly vulnerable. And yeah. Imagine going on Twitter and expressing doubt, saying, I don't know what I think about this issue.
Right.
You would immediately have 50 people shouting at you from various directions about how dare you not have made your mind up? Isn't it completely obvious that you should think this about it?
Mm. Yeah.
We have to find a way to get back that softness, really, and that sense that the world is not a fixed entity that gives us this right or wrong answer.
Right.
It's really cutting us off from our own understanding. It's so oppressive to feel like you have to express absolute certainty all the time, I think.
You mentioned fear a couple of times, right? And I wonder what you think about how do we get past it? Because everywhere I look, I bump into some avenue that leads to fear as the biggest obstacle. Fear of being wrong, like you mentioned. Fear of the going against my cultural norms. Fear of offending. Fear of slowing down, because if I'm not busy, I might have to dwell a little in a fearful place, right? If I can just rush through it, then I don't have to maybe look at something. So how do you think we got there, and how the heck are we going to get out of there?
Yeah, I mean, some of the fears are real. I think there's real economic fear in the air at the moment, and that's leading to fearful behavior around loads of other things, about people that seem other to us, for example. Mm. There is this fear of aggression and violence between sort of factions. Like, I think that's a really valid fear at the moment. But unfortunately, that's the kind of fear that leads us to behave in an aggressive way as well. And it gets ramped up. But I think other fears are misplaced, like the fear of slowing down a little. We struggle to see the harm we're doing when we're constantly going and going and going. And feeding that fear is this sincere belief that we can't afford to stop, that it's dangerous if we stopped. Mm-hmm. And we've now created this language that says it's privileged if you stop. And behind that is this sort of complete lack of understanding that you get stopped if you keep going. Your body will stop you. Mm-hmm. And that's not something that you can wish away with positive thinking. Yeah. The solution to it, I think, is stopping for a while, honestly. Like, I think engaging in reflection, making space for that, learning that as a skill, and getting curious about other people and what they actually think, rather than constructing a sort of straw dog, really. You know, that we think that other people are evil. That's the way we talk about it now, that they're so wrong that they're evil. And I think there's some challenging times ahead for all of us where we have to learn to listen again and to accept that it's possible to think differently to each other, but not to actually want the other group to be exterminated completely, which is where we seem to be heading at the moment somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think just hearing you talk, I just wanted to label it, because it's something we talk to our clients about a lot, and I catch it myself. It's this human tendency to go to the all or nothing.
Yeah.
Evil or amazing, or easy or hard, or full stop, or slowing down and crashing. And what I heard you saying was like the power in that middle space, which I believe, and I think we all believe too.
Which we used to think was just like normal life, but now...
Well, right.
We're thinking in these binaries. Yeah, I think that's so true. I spend a lot of time talking about rest with people because of winter in my book, which is a book about fallow periods and diving into those fallow periods. And what interests me is that when you talk to people about rest, they're kind of a schema that downloads in their head is like laying still on a couch in sweatpants, watching TV for 5 days. And that's horrifying. And you know what? That's not something I can do either. Like, I can't. But actually, I think we need to understand rest as a change of action, a change of scenery, as of working with our hands instead of our brains for a while, or vice versa. Of rest can be an active process, but we need it. We need it to happen in order to give us the opportunity to break down that binary thinking, which is, it's causing us harm.
I'm just so curious about, you know, your own journey to like these fallow periods or finding ways to make space for reflection and processing. And what was your journey, or what were some highlights of your journey?
I think they're going to be lowlights, like, actually, because yeah. I've lived a life that's had a lot of enforced fallow periods, really, like periods of mental illness and physical illness, periods of deep burnout. And I began to recognize a pattern as I moved through life, and which really led me to want to start to write about those, because it felt to me, I mean, now we're actually having quite an open conversation about burnout, which is really gratifying to see, because we've needed it for a long time. But at the time, we weren't really talking about that. And we were talking about failure. And that was like about as positive as we could get about it, like being overt about failure. But I wanted to talk about something else, which was actually the normality of life falling slack sometimes, and the impossibility of being on a constant growth curve, and instead the need to accept this just completely natural and necessary patterning of human life that comes to all of us, no matter how many things you do right, you know, and how good your routines are. Mm. Yeah, so really it was informed by just looking at my own life and not seeing it reflected in mainstream culture, and really wanting to just turn that inside out and say, look, I know I'm not the only one that this is happening to. It's so normal, and we need a language to describe it. Mm-hmm.
It is the thing that we talk about with our friends and family, right? But maybe not even beyond that, because culturally, we're just geared for this whole keep doing, keep doing, keep running, get promoted, get the job, get the this, get the that. And I think we're losing like this sense of peace by like having to keep up with that. So like what you're saying resonates so deeply with me.
And I know you're a swimmer. And so when we're talking about binaries, it's getting away from the sink or swim. This perpetual motion, and a technique that I try to use for myself when I'm giving myself permission to be in that middle ground is just tread water. It's okay. When I was doing lifeguard training, they say that. They say, if you're going to be successful in saving lives, including your own, you need to learn how to just tread water to restore that energy and create that space.
And in fact, I mean, I really, because I wrote about cold water swimming and wintering. And one of the things I noticed coming back at me from that piece of writing was people saying, how long did you stay in the water for? How cold was it? How far did you swim? Did you lose weight? That was, oh my God, that was like the one that came straight out. People will always be tedious. But it was really interesting that they took something that was like a sensory description of being in this gorgeous landscape and like very uncompetitive in the way I described it. Mm-hmm. And straight away we're like, let's quantify this. How can I compete against this? Because she's written a book about it, she must have excelled at it somehow. So how can I benchmark my own experience against this? And I just, it was jaw-dropping to me. It was a real moment of like clarity for me about what we do with really nice suggestions for things to do with our bodies. we turn them dark so quickly. Yeah. And I've noticed that a lot in the last few years.
As an achiever, I totally appreciate how the mind goes there so quickly. And I'm not just saying this to flatter you, but one of the things I find so inspiring about how you carry yourself is with this humility. After watching the talk, after listening to you here, like people will give you credit and you almost gently tone it down in a beautifully self-compassionate, self-affirming, but also open and curious way of, yes, perhaps, but there's still so much more to learn. And this balance, the reason I'm bringing it up is because we're talking about needing to slow down and needing to be curious. And so many of my clients, including myself, because I'm definitely my biggest client, know the knowing about this stuff and really struggle to actually do it, which brings shame and this concept of I should know better. When I read your books, I'm just awestruck, not just by the wisdom that you've cultivated and earned, but also through the gentle compassion that seeps through the way you write. So I'm very curious, like, One, do you feel that's real for you? Because, you know, I'm telling you, you're self-compassionate, but you might be like, eh, I don't feel that at all.
Yeah, thank you. I love the way you've said that, because actually I do spend quite a significant portion of my life being berated by Americans for not bigging myself up enough.
Sorry.
Oh my gosh, you guys.
Sorry. Right? Not these ones.
It's been a really weird few years for me, because I was a very unsuccessful writer who wrote books that 500 people would read if I was lucky. And I was happy with that. And then I had a book that I think probably about 500,000 people have read now. And I was less happy with that. And the reason was that it seemed overblown from my reckoning with myself as a person, what I was being told I was doing for people. And that's true, right? Because I'm not saying I'm not a good writer. I'm a good writer. I'm not saying I've got some wisdom, because my God, as you pointed out, I have earned that wisdom and I've worked really hard to acquire it. Mm-hmm. But I haven't changed people's lives, right? The people have changed their own lives who've read my book. Mm-hmm. And I think we talked at Oxford about the sort of varying interpretations of what wintering's even about, which is mind-blowing, honestly. The different take-homes that come back to me from readers, and the way that it's really clear that people read their own story into a book. And I love that, because my academic work was about how readers co-construct text with writers. And so it delights me when people come back and they've completely changed the story, because that's exactly what I think happens. And I think that's wonderful, because the reader's got so much agency. Mm-hmm. But I'm always going to shrug off the suggestion that I somehow changed someone's life, because actually that is not my work. That is the work of that the person brings to the book. And that puts me in my right place in the world. I don't need to be any bigger than that. I've just got to work on being the best writer I can be. Mm. And to accept my limitations within that too. And I'm really happy in that space. Mm. I don't want to start thinking, yes, I'm the person who changes people's lives. Come on, God. No, that would be a terrible thing to put out in the world and a terrible thing for me. And so I'm going to keep my smallness in the world as much as I can retain it.
Well, it almost sounds like that would create your own obstacles, right? And not allow you to continue your journey. How I read your books was that you were really wonderful about reaching a whole bunch of people and giving them invitations by being vulnerable with our own lives. I'm a firm believer that we create invitations to say, yes, you can do some of these things. You can mirror what I'm doing. Isn't that sort of what we do in parenting?
Oh, we try.
Right? But we try.
And actually, I think I approach parenting in exactly the same way that I approach my books and that I always approach teaching, because I've always been a teacher, which is, come and learn alongside me. Let's walk together and co-learn. And we will both be in a learning process, and we can both talk about that learning process together. And I might know some more things that I pass on to you, but that will definitely be an exchange. Mm-hmm. That's the only way that it's interesting to me to do it. I just can't imagine how tedious it would be to like hand down ways to live as a guru. It would feel completely dishonest to me, but it would also be so boring, like so flat. What a flat relationship to have with people.
And this is so, I'm like sitting here and it's so resonant, just even thinking of my own journey, because what you're describing perfectly is taking that stance of being the creator, right? And Madeline, I know you and I talk all the time about the drama triangle and not being a rescuer, right? And you're just, like Cynthia said, opening the invitation to your readers, but also moving through the world yourself in a way that is in some ways more difficult, I think, than just being the person that is like ramming down knowledge. Yeah.
I love this concept of learn alongside me. And it, to me, it really resonates with coaching. And we're trying to help our clients know what they already know, but are maybe having a hard time accessing. But I can't help but always reflect when I've had a coaching engagement that I'm learning something too. And it makes the makes the engagement more powerful, I think. You know, it's a real partnership, and being vulnerable together is, I personally enjoy that opportunity to be vulnerable together with other people who are on a similar journey.
And I just think that in the sort of mainstream self-help market, which is part of my Venn diagram for sure, the opposite is often happening. Mm-hmm. And what we so often see, I used to be a literary scout, so I used to read a lot of these books. So I have this terrifying market overview of the way these things are approached. But what we often see is the writer saying, you've got a problem. I see that problem. I know how to solve it. Mm-hmm. Here are 10 easy steps. And what is never followed up is the percentage of people that manage to even follow those 10 easy steps to the end, let alone to succeed in them or to let them stick in their lives. And that leaves the reader with this hideous sense of failure. Mm-hmm. And that was my insight as a reader. Like before I got my autism diagnosis, I thought I was like a broken neurotypical person rather than a thriving autistic person. And I just constantly, in my view, failed at all of these books that I bought to try and fix myself. Mm-hmm. It was wretched. It was a wretched way to feel. Mm-hmm. What a terrible thing to keep doing to people. And, mm-hmm. and we're still reproducing it all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm. The phrase that's coming to mind for me is someone else's answers will never be your solution. And
yeah, that's really true.
What we're definitely praising you like the four quality Americans that we are. But
yeah, I will have to go into hiding after this. This is like a cultural offense. <for that. laughs>
You can tell your team that we're to blame, but they're like, why does she never want to do a podcast again? But really, I have this image in my mind that as you're living your life, you're painting these beautiful visions, these vignettes, right? Mm-hmm. And that your books or the way you speak about your experience is like granting visitors free entry into your museum, not so that you can tell them how to interpret the art, but rather so they can interpret it themselves. Mm-hmm. And that openness comes with such a sense of security as an artist. And to bring the metaphor to who you are, it comes with a sense of security of who you are, right? I have lived this life. Here is my interpretation. Here is what I have learned from it. You may learn something different. That's okay. I'm unattached to that. And that unattachment brings back the beginning of this conversation to me, which is that you have to be very disengaged from fear in order to get there. What are some of the practices that you cultivate that help to keep you in a space where you can harbor that much confidence, really, in your sense of self?
I wouldn't, in lots of ways, I wouldn't think about it as an ongoing practice, but I think it was part of my learning as I became a writer, was to first of all kind of think, I had to learn to love writing for the process rather than the product. I think that's the best way to phrase it. That when I started writing as an adult, I was first of all very fixated on the end result, and I wanted to have this novel, and the novel was going to be amazing. It was going to change everybody's lives and my life, and it was going to be so perfect, and everyone that had hated me at school was going to suddenly love me, and you know, like all of that.
Yes.
I still hear writers, like new writers, say that back to me now, and I just think, yeah, that's what you think is going to happen, but what you're actually going to do is spend 5 years wrestling with your soul to produce your first full-length piece of work. And the weird thing is, if you stick with it, that's the bit that you're going to end up loving about all of this, is the process and that experience of working through a set of ideas and drawing in information and finding ways to like frame and reframe what you're trying to say. That's the bit that I'm attached to, is my right that I have to assert every time I sit down to write. Two different rights. Mm. To produce this work, to create, to be in process. Mm. And as soon as that landed for me, I really lost interest in the end result in any significant way. I've made it. It's like blowing a bubble and watching it float away. Yeah. I'm unattached to that, really. Mm. In fact, I find it quite hard to do promotional rounds for books because I've written it, guys. Interview me about it while I'm writing. I probably would refuse to tell you anything. But that's when I'm interested in talking. I'm like, there it goes, it's gone. You guys have it now. It's fine. I'm comfortable with that.
Oh my God. My brain is like, oh my God, I love this. I'm like floating away in the joy of it all. And then I come crashing back down to earth and I'm like, but how, Catherine? How? Give me the 10 easy steps, Catherine.
Mm-hmm. You have to slow down and be messy, that? Madeline.
As I'm sitting here, I'm like, okay, yeah. What would be the next great question I could ask to get her to give me a framework that our like actionable little listeners can go and apply?
Right. I heard a framework, right? Right? I did. I heard stay in the journey, stay in the process, right? Learn to love that, which is the messy middle, isn't it? It's the unpredictability. It's where we use the most curiosity. In my years, every time I try to focus on the destination or even the start is where I get myself all in a pickle, right? Because really it is. It's about the living of the life, not the life lived. Yeah. Right.
It is. I spent an hour talking to my therapist about this morning. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm a third through my next book. And I'm still at the stage where I'm just trying to get the first set of words down to find the basic shape. And it's like having a big block of clay and making like big gestures in it towards the shape. It's really hard. It's really. You have to have so much perseverance. You have to have so much faith in the process because you can't have faith in the product. The product is awful. It's unspeakable. It makes no sense. It's incoherent. It's so grim. Mm. And I can't finish that book if I don't have faith in the process, which is just turning up every day, opening that goddamn file with all the awful words in it and adding some more words to them. Yeah. That's all I can do. And I can only do that meaningfully by thinking every day, what is interesting about this right now? What is interesting? What's the next thing I'm interested in saying after the sentence that I wrote at the end of yesterday's session? That's the only way I can do it.
You just lit my heart up when you said the word faith. Like it was dancing on my tongue right before you said it. Faith is this new word I'm learning to embrace for myself, which when it is at its strongest, allows me to be at even 10% knowing or 20% knowing. It doesn't force me to get up to 80 or 90 to mitigate that risk. It's that free fall, that feeling of freedom that comes with faith. Faith is really the word of process, isn't it? It is, and I dance between faith and trust, but trust for me has become so solid. It's needed to be so perfect in this world. Mm-hmm. And faith is something that seems so reserved for just religious conversations. Yeah. And so I avoided using it for the longest time, but it just keeps coming up. So it's amazing you just said that.
Can I recommend a book by Ejay Temelkuran, who I interviewed for my own podcast a while ago? Wait, I'm going to have to find the title of it because I don't ever remember anything. Sorry, this is going to ruin your podcast recording. It is called Together 10. I'm promoting someone else's book. Together 10 Choices for a Better Now. Ooh. I think this is the book that you need right now because Ece is she's a Turkish journalist who's living in exile because she's under threat of imprisonment if she comes back under the current government. But she has devoted her life to thinking about the kind of rise of the populist right and how we combat that. So very relevant to the world of Donald Trump, for example, the world of Boris Johnson. We all know the effects of these kind of figures. But one of the things that she says, and I do not want to quote her wrong because she's incredibly smart, but her first chapter is choose faith over hope. The way that she says it is essentially that hope is too doubtful. Faith is wholehearted and we throw ourselves towards it, whatever happens. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such a lovely way of combining solidity with vulnerability. Yeah. The solidity you find is your faith. Mm-hmm. You don't know what it's going to achieve, but you throw yourself towards that instead of merely hoping. She's like, hope is not enough anymore. Mm-hmm. I think you might need that right now.
Thank you.
I think there might be another Nomi book club in the future.
I know. Right. Oh, yeah. We didn't even say that Wintering was our book club, our very first book club book. So it will. And we read it in the winter, too. We were very good.
The way to do it. Right. Follow the made rules. In summer.
We followed the rules. Everyone was suffering and we read it in winter.
Perfect. It's perfect.
But truly, thank you for sharing that. And so one of the things that's coming up here again and again is just being in process, how to be in process, the mindsets of process. What are the times that you feel yourself falling out of this mindset? What jolts you back into that outcome-driven space?
Oh my goodness. I work in I'm paid by an industry that commissions outcomes for me rather than processes. Mm. And that can be really hard. There's something about receiving a sum of money, like a book advance, which is a kind of gamble against what your book is expected to sell when you finished it. I always, every time I sign a book contract, find that really restricting. And it as you say, it jolts me out of the space of process and into this kind of thinking around, I now have to create something that is worth this sum of money. And I've worked really hard for years to disconnect the idea of hours representing money. Like, that was really hard for me. That's how I'd learned to think about what I earned and what my work was worth. Like, how many hours does it take? If I divide that by what I've been paid, then I'm going to get my worth. I'm going to get like a number that represents my hourly worth. I've worked really hard on ditching that, because that doesn't work for me as a writer. It doesn't work for anyone, incidentally, but I really get that other people have to deal with that reality. I also have to just leave the idea to rest for a while after that big financial moment has happened, so that can just die down in me for a little while. Mm. Because otherwise I will sit down and try and write the book that is worth that sum of money, which always feels really oppressive to me.
Yeah.
And then when I get back to it, the way I do it is I trust my routine. I can do that mindlessly. All I have to do is show up for these hours every day. And I might not produce anything good for many months, and that's often the case. Mm-hmm. But if I can just fall back on this exterior pattern that I know I'm in, and not, I don't reply to emails in that time, I don't take phone calls, I don't take texts, I don't engage in any other kind of work. I'm just there to either read or write, whether that's in my notebook or adding to my manuscript. Like, I just show up, I just show up, I just show up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's how I do it.
What I'm hearing is that you know yourself really well. Mm. You've worked really hard to know yourself too. Seriously, I know it sounds silly, but you know yourself well enough to know the boundaries that you need to put around things, even as small as I cannot check emails, because I know, rather than beating yourself up for how you respond to emails, not giving yourself the bait. Like, that is something that's quite hard to do. We always think it's about making sure that we don't react a certain way, rather than being like, no, I know I'm going to react that way. Mm-hmm. So how can I draw a boundary that's going to support me, rather than setting myself up for failure? So in trusting your process or having that faith, you're building a process that helps you succeed as well. Like, it's not by magic that it's happening. It's by intentional design.
Right. Absolutely. I think one of the things I always accept is that process is never going to be fixed. It's going to change a bit every time. It's going to have to fit around my life.
Yeah.
So for example, when I was writing Wintering, I had to pull my son out of school because he wasn't coping. And that book got written in the cafes of soft play centres while I was going, yeah, great, I see you, have a lovely day. Yeah, yeah, you carry on. No, don't come back yet. You keep enjoying yourself. Right. Yep. Bye. Would you like an orange squash? Great. Off you go again. Like, that was like the process of that book, but it was still, that was how I could show up at that point. Yeah. That was how I could get an hour. Now it's a little more luxurious because he goes to school again. I have somewhere to write that I walk to every morning. That was my new innovation. I knew that would help me to almost have a commute to my work where I could change my mind space from the domestic to the creative. So I looked really hard for a place to do that, and I found it. Location is incredibly secret. And I do that every morning now. That's become a key part of my routine, which really helps me to just lay some stuff aside temporarily and only be in that place. Yeah. I know loads of women who write on their kitchen table surrounded by the whole domestic detritus. I can't.
Yeah.
I just can't, because I'd be like, oh, I just clean that up a bit. Oh, well, you know, yeah. No, bad.
I'm just curious. So you just described so perfectly, like, how you're showing up for yourself over and over again. Like, you're committed to giving yourself the tools that you need and to show up for yourself. And a lot of us have a hard time doing that. We put everything other than ourselves first.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, where does that commitment stem from? Why is it so important to you that you're showing up for yourself and setting yourself up for success?
This is a dirty word that loads of people hate. It's ambition. I have this ambition to write the best books I can and to keep on writing them for as long as people read them. That ambition is, it's really funny how we find it hard to talk about that. That's seen as a really hard-edged kind of quality to have. I'm really resistant to that. Like, my ambition is this sort of really vulnerable space that is about my desire. Mm-hmm. And I just reconnect with my desire. That's the way I think about it. Like, I remember my desire. I sit with my notebook and re-engage with that desire, which is such a pure thing. Like, it's we've primal. Connected it with like the 80s sort of everything's about money. My desire is not connected to that. My desire is about making work and making work that's meaningful. Mm. And I just have to keep turning my attention back to that desire to stay on that path. And that, yeah, everyone deserves to have that. I've worked through the phase of thinking, how dare I? Mm. And there will, you know what, like, there will always be people in your life that still say that to you, I think. Mm. But what's the alternative? Mm. Watching TV for 70 years and then dying. I just don't, right. I don't get it.
Yeah. I'm reading a book by Richard Rohr, and it's called Falling Up. And he talks a lot about this continual sort of, it can be a battle between the ego and the soul. So when we're talking about some of this stuff, we're really talking about when our ego gets in the way versus our soul and how to balance those. Once again, we're in the middle. We're not at the extremes. We're not at the either or. Yeah. I know for myself, that's what I do, because I agree with you. I'm like, at the end of the day, when I'm 150, right, and I'm saying my last goodbyes, I'm not doing the laundry list of what satisfied my ego that made my life worth living. I'm doing the laundry list of what satisfied my soul.
And that helps you towards balance as well, because the other things that satisfy my soul are making sure my family are well cared for and being with my friends and walking and swimming. And if you can engage with your values and your desire and the core of you, then you can let everything flow outwards from there. It doesn't have to be forced. It doesn't have to be regimented. It's got nothing to do with discipline. It's just, how do I meet all of these needs that I'm now letting myself feel?
I think a big part of it as well, though, is that we don't realize we're in the middle. We're talking so much about being in the messy middle. And Mom, you just said 100 when you're 100 and whatever, hopefully 150 looking back.
I loved 150.
Getting longer and longer. I keep reading statistics that
You don't have to explain yourself, girlfriend, as one of my favorite humans on this earth. 150 for you suits me just fine. So that's great. But as someone who's on the earlier side of the journey, I think 18 is like where it stopped. And then 25 was the end, right? And I feel like adulthood has been this perpetual end state that, like, we don't talk about being an adult like you're still in the middle. It's like the second you enter the workforce, it's over. And that's why they start calling retirement your second childhood. But I'm like, what? So right now is the middle. We are in different stages of the middle, but we're all in the middle. And I think what's so bookendish about these childhoods is there's two points in our life where society lets us be playful again. That's when we're little, and that's when we're retired. And then there's this workforce right in the middle.
Awful. I mean, you're talking to someone that's never managed to hold down a proper job. So I'm not the best person to ask this, because I find it very easy to step outside of the workplace. Like, I really would rather be poor. But I don't have the whole health insurance thing to contend with that you guys have to contend with, which I realize changes everything. But the idea that we put everything on hold for the most healthy, intelligent, questing years of our life for work is utterly bizarre. And it doesn't require walking out of jobs in the way that I so often have. it requires us to really engage with what part work plays in our life and to rebalance that. Mm-hmm. My mum lives in Spain. I don't think Americans can imagine, and certainly not British people either, like the balance that people in that part of Europe find in their everyday lives, still working, still providing for their families, still doing stimulating things, but just an acknowledged rebalancing of what's important as well as work. Mm-hmm. And that's all it takes. It's actually a really small adjustment. But at the moment, we've got this really weird impression that work is something that, yeah, you're going to be oppressed by. And so you just got to live with that for as long as you can until you burn out.
And it's uncomfortable. And this, I think, is a thread I've seen through this entire conversation is staying in process, staying in the middle, resisting this urge. It requires tolerating discomfort. Yeah. And that is a really challenging skill to build because the only thing that does it is exposure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's learning to not seek a final answer or a final state of being. Like, you're never going to settle. That's not the aim of any of this. That would be so dreadful, to find your final shape when you're 26, and then that's it. Thanks, guys. I'm just going to stay the same for the next 50 years. Thank you very much. I'm done now. Awful. And the world's going to change around you.
It's that flexibility. I think it's also just reminding ourselves, and it's very appropriate with your work too, Catherine. We are animals, right? Living in a natural world. And so all it takes, if we really want to challenge that belief, is looking around to our left and right and realizing that the flower, right, in our garden is not the same flower that it was yesterday. Mm-hmm. And that it's perpetually, constantly changing in emotion. Right. And so to try to not have that, to try to arrive at some kind of fixed destination is against our inherent nature.
Totally. And also I look at my cat and I think my cat has never tried to have less sleep in order to make its life more efficient. It just sleeps when it's tired. It eats when it's hungry. It brings in live mice for me to scurry around and collect and throw out again. It's fine. Yeah. But we as humans are uniquely this species who are constantly trying to optimize our basic functioning as creatures, our basic creaturely functioning.
Right.
And it's actually quite a weird thing to do when you stop to think about it.
If you stop.
If you stop, yeah. I spent my whole life stopping to think about it. It's weird. The weirdness just overwhelms me most of the time.
Yeah.
But that's what we
do. This is true. And I think that one of the things, hopefully, that gets you to stop is by building community with people or starting to listen to things and expose yourself to content that makes you stop to think. Way at the beginning, you were talking about how if we don't slow down, life has a way of making us slow down. And I think that one of the ways that we can force the slowing down is to surround ourselves with people that help encourage the behaviors and content that helps encourage the wisdom that we want to show up in. Because it's really hard to do this stuff ourselves without tune-ups from any external forces.
We think about these things very individualistically, yeah.
We think we have to do everything on our own. It's horrible. My inclination is to want to button this episode up absolutely perfectly, but I think it's great to just leave it hanging.
Yes, quite. I can find a narrative I can get behind.
But leaving it open and letting people take the value they're going to take. So we will close the podcast here, but I would love if with our couple extra minutes, can we just do some rapid fire questions at you?
Of course. I will do my best.
You guys know the question I want to ask because it came out of the intro. This is just such a serious question, but we are curious to know what you're pickling right now.
Okay. I've recently pickled some Japanese muli, but I've done it in the Japanese fermentation style. So you just toss it in a bag. You slice it up, toss it in a bag with sugar, salt and turmeric and leave it for a couple of weeks. It smells awful, but it tastes incredible. So you have to double seal it in your fridge, but it's brilliant. That's the best pickle I've made for ages.
Right? I feel like there's some sort of metaphor between your love of pickling and your love of process.
Actually, I tell you the link. Most of the time I make the things and I don't want to eat them. I just like having done it. I fermented some nasturtium seeds last year. And then just looked at them and thought, that looks absolutely disgusting. And I had to be sat down by one of my friends who made me taste them. And they were really nice, but I'd lost interest in them completely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe like, no, just like
your, yeah, just like your writing, you need to let your pickling out into the world. So you do it to give, not to taste.
That's exactly it. Yeah. I love to give them away. I don't want to eat them. I want to eat someone else's pickles. It's weird. I can't explain
Right.
It's an exchange.
What's the most difficult emotion to capture in your writing?
They're all hard, actually. And I honestly think the way to approach it is to not try to do it. To actually try and show what happens and to leave the emotion open, because for me, that lets your reader flow their emotion into that space. Mm-hmm. Whereas actually describing emotion is always so overblown. Like the only way you could get the sheer strength of that feeling is to totally over describe it. So I actually always try not to describe it and try and take a step back and let that be implied.
What is your, do you have a particular favorite bird at the moment?
Yeah, At the moment, I do go back to these a lot, but starlings, which most people hate them. And I don't know why, but they're just re-emerging in my garden at the moment. And they're always these, they're so curious, aren't they? Yeah. They come in and they're like, little heads are everywhere. And they're not that scared of you. And they keep sitting in my euphorbia plant and eating the seeds as they're clinging on to these swaying branches. And they're so acrobatic. It's really cool.
How does the process of showing up imperfectly without fully formed thoughts pave the way for others to do the same?
I hope it's just leading by example, honestly. I really hope that I can just show people that it can be okay to think on your feet, to wonder, to be uncertain, to be in two minds. I think the more that I can externalize that process, the more I can hopefully give permission for other people to do the same.
What qualities and characteristics do you look for in people that help you to understand that they're safe to be in process with?
It can take a while, can't it, actually? I think you have to really get to know people before you can trust them. But I think for me, it is an absence of judgment. An ability to laugh, actually, is very important. A lack of preciousness about their own work and the ability to talk that through and to point out the flaws in their work as much as the kind of good parts. But I do as well think it's sometimes just a vibe, honestly. I think you can feel it with people that they're going to be open, they're going to be vulnerable, they're going to be relaxed around failure. All of those things are a really good sign. But actually, it's very rare.
It is.
Very, very rare.
Yeah.
I actually find that I prefer to work with visual artists than writers, because they've been through that training, that foundation year at college, where they get cracked open and challenged in really difficult ways and ways that they can't possibly succeed. And I think it makes fantastic practitioners out of the other end of the process. I love working with visual artists.
I love that. We've got a list now of what gets you to come to things. Visual artists, bribing with garlic.
Yes. Starlings. And maybe a pickling. No, she doesn't want to try the pickling. No, other people pickling.
It's fine.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. There is this great icebreaker question that was, what three things would a witch put in a circle to summon you? And so now I feel like we have the answer to that question.
Actually, do you know what? It would be a cold martini, a plate of pickles, and probably a cat. That would do me. Nice. I would be that.
Yes.
I'd be there.
Yes. I feel like I have to send that clip to your team of next time she goes into hiding about a book, just put these three things in a circle
and she'll come out, right?
Instead, that's how it would have
been. We do usually close with a quote because we like to leave our listeners thinking and open and in that euphoria of just needing to explore and be curious. So, Mom, do you have a quote for us?
I do. When I was reading Catherine's book, Enchantment, I had to stop periodically through the entire book and just go a big yes. And I actually even write yes, 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 yes. So thank you for that. The ones I'll pick is different ways of knowing, one that is embedded in the body rather than hived off into the mind, where each landmark unpacks its own mythology.
We love that. Here at Know Me.
Yeah.
Pun yeah. very much intended and orchestrated. No, but seriously, if you haven't read Catherine's books yet, I hope, even though we didn't really talk about them too much.
Oh, I've talked about them too often. That's something new. That's so me.
Go catch the bubbles. She's released into the atmosphere.
That's right.
That is a better way. That's a great way of putting
right?
it.
One is called wintering. One's called enchantment. And one.
Exactly. My publicist always says, like, you will talk about the actual book, won't you? And I'm like, oh, yes.
Maybe. Yeah. It's so good. But we'll talk about it for you. And don't worry. But truly, reading the books is very much similar to having a conversation like this. You are incredibly conversational in your writing, despite the fact that there's no dialogue with your reader directly. So yes, you soak it in, receive, let it wash over you. And we really appreciate your being with us. We have a little something that we'd like to share with you. And because you've listened this long, you get in on this secret. It's not announced anywhere yet, but we are launching our signature Nomi program. It is 9 months and involves all sorts of juicy things. It involves group coaching, one-on-one work, as well as beautiful restorative options of different things you can do to rejuvenate yourself. The reason we're doing this is because it's really hard to stay positive, kind, aligned, and supporting ourselves and the people that we love in this really chaotic world. And so this program is a robust source of support to help you get what you need so that you can support the people in your life. It helps us to deepen our awareness with self, grow in a sustainable way, and show others how they can support us, as well as build environments that help support us. So if that sounds interesting to you, take a perusal, leave your email, and we will get to you as the top of our list because we love our podcast listeners so much. Thanks for hanging with us, and until next time,
be well.
Thanks for listening to Being Curious with Nomi. Did you learn something new or feel inspired by something in this episode? Then please pass it along. Sharing our podcast is the best way you can help us to inspire more self-awareness and curiosity in the world. And if you're curious about how we can support you, head to nomi.com to see how we could work together one-to-one.
We know it takes a village, and we're grateful you're part of ours. This is Cynthia,
Maggie,
Ellen, and Madeline
asking you to be good to you.